Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is April Young Bennett. She is author of Ask a Suffragist, Stories in Wisdom from America's First Feminist. Since the Women's March on Washington and the Me Too movement, a new, more diverse generation of feminists is raising questions about how to effect change. Ask a Suffragist, Stories in Wisdom from America's First Feminist, channels the first generation of American feminists as exemplars and advisors as we seek modern solutions. Activists with urgent causes to support don't have time to read dull history textbooks. Fortunately, American suffragists lived radical lives that were in no way boring. Instead of droning on like an encyclopedia about dates, minute meetings, and genealogy charts, America's First Feminists discuss relationships, strategies, and activism, focusing on stories that are particularly relevant for modern feminist activists, whether for inspiration and emulation, or to avoid repeating past mistakes. For more information, you can visit April's website, which is April Young and the letter B for Bennett.com. AprilYoungB.com. So with that, I'd like to welcome April to the show. Good day, April.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. This topic of feminism and suffrage, I mean, this is very timely, in today's world. So I have to start by asking, where did the idea come from? I mean, what kind of inspired you to write a book, and especially entitled it Ask a Suffragist?
When I started out, I was not an author, I was an activist. And so I was working on lots of feminist activist campaigns, and I was working with other people, very passionate, very exciting, wonderful people that spent a lot of time brainstorming, coming up with ideas. We talked a lot on the internet. On the internet, you can have a rolling meeting that just goes on for virtually forever and keep talking and keep discussing things and keep bringing up ideas. And we were doing that a lot. And I started to notice some things happening to us that.
Okay, April, so you said you basically started as an activist and really didn't have the intention of being an author. But now with Facebook, you said that it's kind of like an ongoing discussion. I mean, that's something that the people, the suffragists, didn't have have it at their fingertips to be able to employ.
Right, but I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing, because we spent so much time brainstorming, and I started to notice things happening to us that were similar to things that had happened to in history to other people. For example, there was one time when I marched with several other women, hundreds of other women actually, to a male-only meeting, and we requested entrance, and we were denied entrance. But we were told as a compromise that we could listen outside from our cell phones in the rain, and we could hear the conference but not participate in it. And that reminded me of something that I knew of from history that happened to Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. They went to the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. They traveled thousands of miles to get there. And when they arrived, they were told they weren't welcome because they were women. But in the end, a compromise was made, and they were allowed to listen to the meeting from a balcony behind a curtain but not participate. And so I was seeing things happening to us that were similar to things that had already happened in history. And knowing that people had already been through things like this before, I wanted to start studying and learning more about these people and how they handled these situations so that I could be a better activist myself.
Wow. That's, you know, that's amazing that when you think about, you know, just the parallel, you know, I mean, it, you know, it's been what, how long, but I'm almost 150 years. What's the period covered
about 200
in
years.
Your book? Okay.
Yeah, it starts in the 1830s. So nearly 200
okay.
years back, we're seeing similar things that are still happening to modern activists today.
Wow. That kind of makes me sad, you know, when I think about it, you know, that, you know, so much time. But, you know, I think that it's interesting that you were able to recognize, you know, that parallel. Now, had you known about a historical event ahead of time, you know,
That was one of the most famous events in suffrage history. So I was familiar with that one, but there was so much more that I didn't know. And so that's why I started studying it, because I thought, if I'm seeing this parallel just for based on this one incident that I happen to know about already, what else was there that I could learn from those people who had already come before me? And that's when I started studying it. And the book is written almost like a conversation between me and these women. Each chapter begins with a question that I would love to ask some of the activists who came before me. And each chapter is based around that question and looks at how those activists really did handle those situations, how they did get through things like that, so that I can look to their lives and I can emulate what they did right and also hopefully avoid repeating some of the same mistakes.
Well, so I have to know, and that the resolution of the listening in on the conference, is there a better, I mean, after that happened, you know, and they weren't included, how did the suffragists at the time, obviously they hadn't conquered it if it's happening 200 years later, but kind of, did they have any kind of plan of attack, something like that?
There were some men in their party who supported them, who debated the issue with the other men who were allowed to attend, and they actually spent a whole day debating the issue of inclusion of women and made a lot of valid points that went on the record for people to look at in the future. But in the end, they came up with a compromise and they agreed that all the male delegates would vote on whether to include the women. And unfortunately, 90% of the men voted that they did not want women included. And so they weren't at that time. But this incident really mobilized people. At that time, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she's now one of our most famous suffragists in history. At that time, she wasn't even involved in the movement. But just being there for this experience and seeing what happened here is really what motivated her to start a women's rights movement. And it's part of the reason we have the rights we have today.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, in the title, it says suffragist. And I've heard the term suffragette. Is there a difference or are those interchangeable?
Well, today we usually use the term interchangeably. So when you hear someone refer to a suffragette, they're probably just talking about anyone who fought for women's suffrage. But at the time, there was a difference. Suffragettes were generally in England. That's the only place they used that term at that time. And my book is about American suffragists who called themselves suffragists. And so in keeping with honoring the way they chose to identify, I call my book Ask a Suffragist, using their terminology. One thing I do like about the word suffragist is that it is gender neutral. When we talked about suffragettes, we're usually talking about women, but especially here in America, many of the early suffragists, people who believed in women's equality and wanted women's suffrage, were men. And so I like that this gender neutral term is inclusive of all the people who fought for women's suffrage in America.
Well, I like that. Yeah, I mean, I agree. No, I hadn't really thought of gender neutrality of suffragists, but it is. And that is a definite plus for that. And, you know, I think it's now in your book, do you, in addition to talking, you know, like with suffragists or, I mean, you know, highlighting suffragists, do you include men, the men who were active in that movement as well in the book?
Absolutely. One of those questions that I bring up that I write a whole chapter about is, what is men's role in a feminist movement? And in that chapter, I focus particularly on feminist men and what they did to help women to gain women's rights. Two of the most famous are William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass. Those two men, they're most known today because they were abolitionists. But not only were they abolitionists, they were fervent supporters of women's rights.
Wow, okay. Well, you know, those are people that you don't, when you think about a suffrage movement, a lot of times you don't realize that there were, that men were involved as well. So in your book, you mentioned are America's first feminists. So who is the, there's a picture, the image on your book cover is of a woman. Who is that and why did you choose her to grace the cover?
That is Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. And she was a very important feminist and abolitionist just before the Civil War and afterwards. I chose her because she has such an interesting story. She was born and raised in Maryland, and she moved to Pennsylvania. It was supposed to be temporary. She moved to Pennsylvania with the intention of getting a job and maybe returning to Maryland later. But while she was there, Maryland passed a law that any person of color, and she was a person of color, who crossed the Maryland border could be captured and sold into slavery. And so that meant she couldn't go back home. So she was trapped in Pennsylvania, and this kind of ignited her desire to be an abolitionist. And she took a job with the Maine Anti-Slavery Society and started traveling the country talking about the need to abolish slavery. And then later on, after she had already been doing this, had been a very effective advocate for the abolition of slavery for many years, she got married and she used the money that she had earned from her travels, her speeches, and from writing books. She was an author who wrote fiction and nonfiction and poetry. She had saved up a bunch of money over the course of time by being very frugal, and she used that money when she got married to buy a house and a farm for her husband and her new stepchildren. Unfortunately, only 3 years after she got married, her husband died. At that time, she had just given birth to a child, and she had all these stepchildren too now. And because of the way the laws were at that time, everything that she had purchased as a married woman, the house, the farm, it was all considered the property of her husband, even though she had paid for it. And as soon as he died, it was all confiscated to pay her husband's debts. And so that left her impoverished, and that's when she joined the women's rights movement. And so she was a very exciting and interesting person. And when she joined the women's rights movement, she was already very bold. She'd been working on anti-slavery causes for so long. She was a very effective activist. And she did a great job of doing some training of some of the white women who were in the women's rights movement about the need for them to be more intersectional, more inclusive of people of different races within the movement. So she made a wonderful contribution.
Wow. It's interesting that, that she, lost everything. But even, before that, going around giving speeches, I would think, for a black woman to be traveling around giving speeches, would have been a rare occasion. I mean, or maybe it's just that, we haven't heard of people like her.
Well, she certainly wasn't the only black activist. But yes, it was unusually difficult to be a black woman who is traveling around being an itinerant speaker at this time. People were scared for her at times. Right after the Civil War ended, during Reconstruction, she went to the South alone and went on a tour of the South talking about women's rights and talking about racial justice at a time when it was pretty scary down there. It was a very volatile period in history, and she went to the most volatile part of the country all by herself. She was a brave woman.
Wow, I would think, you know, that's just that's the kind of person you'd want to have share a meal with and really learn a little bit more about what she saw and did. So now the you said that there are other Black activists. Now you cover that in your book, but you also cover the main ones, the most famous of suffragists.
Absolutely. I try to be diverse. One thing that I've noticed is I've studied so much about this movement in other books. I've read a lot of biographies, and I love biographies. But a problem if you just read a biography is you tend to you see the world as if it's all revolving around this one person, this one hero. But as an activist who has actually worked in movements, I know that movements usually aren't built by solitary heroes. They're built by tens, hundreds of rank and file workers, normal people, many of whom are very different from each other. And so one of my goals in this book was to give a broader perspective of the women's rights movement, show it from lots of different people's perspectives. And so I was careful to include people of different racial backgrounds, people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. Many of the women in my book were immigrants to the United States, and so they had a very different perspective on the movement than people who were born and raised here. And so I tried to include lots of different people with different perspectives because all of these people were important to the movement, and it wouldn't have accomplished what it did if only one kind of woman had been running it.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, for lasting change, it really does require, you know, a broad tent, you know, to work with. But, you know, I still go back to when we started the show, 200 years. It really haven't seen, you know, that much change. And so in any of these stories, any of the women that you highlight, have any of them, did any of them express, now I understand that you use like letters and diaries and all kinds of other sources to in the book, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would certainly bumps up the, the level of interest rather than just a textbook. But in any of those, was there a suffragist who, you know, just had that a sense of futility, you know, that sometimes, you know, that it, what they were trying to work toward was just, was it worth it? Was it going to change? You know what I mean? Because I would think that that would be, you know, for an activist, you know, to not affect change would be very, you know, challenging or disheartening. But so the fact is it goes on for years. So did any of those suffragists that you have in the book experience that kind of sense or express that kind of sense of futility?
You know, the very first person in the book that my book talks about, who was really the maybe the first person to speak out at a time when women were expected to be silent, was Maria W. Stewart. Maria Stewart was an indentured servant in Boston. She was a Black woman, and so she wasn't a person of high rank in society. And yet, she was the first person at a time period when it was taboo for women to give public speeches to say, I'm going to give a public speech about the things I care about, and I'm going to invite the public. I'm going to put it in the newspaper. I'm going to advertise. I'm going to have people come and hear what I have to say. So she did this at a time when it was considered outrageous. At that time, it was considered fine for a woman to speak to other women alone in their parlor, but it wasn't okay for a woman to go out in public and give a speech in front of men. That was fine for men to do, by the way. It was fine for men to go give speeches to anyone they wanted to talk to, but for a woman to give a speech in front of men was not okay. So she did this at a time when it wasn't popular, and it was a big taboo. She was breaking taboos in her society. Her speeches were not well received. people were really angry that she was giving speeches to mixed gender audiences, that she was a Black woman who was daring to speak out at a time when Black people were looked down upon. It didn't go terribly well. But she was also a brilliant woman with wonderful things to say about racial justice, about women's rights, about ending poverty. And after about 3 years of working as an activist, she did come to the conclusion that people just weren't ready for what she had to say, that she wasn't getting through to her community. She felt like other Black people in Boston needed to work out issues amongst themselves, like, for example, the way they were treating women who tried to give speeches to them before they would be ready to take on their oppressors. So she did get discouraged and find some issues with her community. So she did retire a little bit early, but before she did, she brought her speeches to William Lloyd Garrison for publication, and he published them, and they became very influential. And even though people hadn't liked her speeches when she was giving them in person, when people started reading her words, which were truly inspired, it inspired other women to also become activists and really was the beginning of the movement.
Wow. That's good to hear. You know, that, you know, and for the people who are active at the moment, you know, to be encouraged that even though it, you know, it may seem, you know, the fruits may seem, you know, far down the road, at least there is an impact. And sometimes you don't realize the impact that, you know, that you can make. Like for example, using her, for example, you know, speeches not well received, written word well received, you know. So I guess it says a lot about how one presents their desired goal, you know.
Well, you keep trying, right? You try different things. If what you try at first doesn't work, then you try something else.
Mm-hmm.
And in her case, I think she was quite wise. I think she was right that the people in her community probably weren't ready for what she had to say. But when what she had to say got in the newspaper, it met a broader audience, and it found those people who were ready for what she had to say and who were ready to do something about it.
Wow, that's something. Well, April, we're about halfway through, so I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in and ask April any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in, and we'll get to April. And then when we come back after the break, April, in addition to that fertility, one of the, you know, major challenges for women is balancing, you know, family life, and then the job and or activism, and, you know, so when we come back, maybe we can, you can talk to us about maybe a suffragist who kind of attacked that issue of balance in family. Okay?
That sounds great.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,400 shows we have had over the past 9 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide: books, photography, a wellness store, and self-publishing assistance. Our show is a free podcast on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms at the top of our homepage. Our website, biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my special guest is April Young Bennett, and we are talking about her new book, Ask a Suffragist: Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. And again, you can find out more by visiting April's website, which is aprilyoungb.com. That's April Young and the letter B, as in Bennett, www.thebusinessmindset.com. So with that, we're back, April.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, okay, great. So balancing family along with, you know, activist kinds of duties or responsibilities, I would have to think that particularly in the period you're talking about, that would have been a real challenge. You know, if you don't have dishwashers, you know, you have washers and dryers and all of the other conveniences of life right now.
Right. It was difficult. It still is difficult. This is something that women still are talking about today, about how to balance the many activities they have in their lives. And some feminists say that women shouldn't be talking about this anymore, that men don't talk about it, so why should we? And I kind of think the opposite. I think that we need more men to be thinking about balancing their lives, because I think that if everyone, no matter what their gender, was working towards this, it would be easier on all of us. Right now, we still have, even in our modern society, a woman is more likely to be the one who does the dishes in a household, even if she works full time. And so, like you said, back when the movement began, there weren't dishwashers. Things were even more difficult. And a lot of the people who were involved in the suffrage movement were either single women or married men, because single women didn't have families to take care of. And married men, it seems, throughout history, have never had a problem with this. Their wives just pick up the slack. So there was one exception. And that was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I mentioned her, how she became so excited about women's rights after being excluded at the London Anti-Slavery Convention. Well, she was one of the few activists who was married and had children, many children, very small, very young, very demanding children. She had a lot of work to do, and it was hard for her to get things done. And the thing about her was that she was also a brilliant writer. And so other people who were involved in the suffrage movement kept approaching her, wanting her to sit and write. And she'd say, I can't write because I've got kids in my arms. I don't have a free hand. I can't write. She's like, I can think about this while I'm washing the dishes, but I can't sit down and write it. I've got all these children to take care of. And so it was very challenging for her. And one of the things that really made it possible for her to stay involved in the movement, even though she did have so much work to do around the house, was Susan B. Anthony. Susan B. Anthony was a close friend of hers, and Susan B. Anthony cared so much about having Elizabeth's talents invested in the movement that she would come over to the house and she'd say things like, okay, today I'm going to bake the puddings and take care of the kids. I want you to sit in your office and write. And she would give her that space that she needed to get things done.
Wow. Well, everyone needs a friend like that.
Everyone does. Another person who was a friend of Elizabeth's was Lucy Stone. Lucy Stone was one of those single women who had time because she was single. And she had vowed to always stay single. She was just going to stay single because she felt like these causes that she was working toward were very important. And she believed that if she got married, it would come to a complete stop. There would be no way to continue her work. And so she didn't intend to get married. When she met Henry Blackwell, Henry Blackwell started courting her, and he very much wanted to marry her, and she just thought that if she did that, it would end her activist career. And in the book, I talk a lot about their courtship and how it went on for quite some time with Lucy resisting because she was so worried about how this would affect her activist career and the causes she cared about. And in the end, it didn't. And the reason it didn't is because when she did marry Harry, she married someone who cared about the cause as much as she did, and they became partners in the work. They actually went on to be suffrage leaders together and to work on the cause together, to run organizations together. They started a suffrage journal that they edited together. And so she really gained a partner in this work instead of somebody who would hold her back and keep her tied down to the house.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's, that's definitely the way to solve that, and it's really, for her to have felt so strongly and also in recognize, for her, what the priorities were, and I would think that, setting priorities and managing the various roles would have been a real difficult thing.
Yeah, by the time she and Harry got married, and when they did get married, by the way, they turned their wedding into a protest of unfair marriage laws that affected women. they actually made their whole wedding around women's rights. So by the time they got married, Harry knew very much what he was getting into, and Lucy had negotiated with him and explained to him exactly what she wanted in their marriage and how she wanted them to continue the work. And so he agreed, and he was ready, and he was prepared to do it. And I think that also helped, was there was that communication between them, and he knew her expectations before he went into the marriage.
Yeah. So now, for women who are activists who read this book, it seems that the book gives a lot more attention, you know, to relationships and just, you know, circumstances, you know, but it did seem that if you're going to learn lessons, there's a lot of lessons of, what becomes effective in a movement, but there's also lessons, it appears, and like in this case, that, if you feel strongly about your work, then a perfect mate for you would be someone who feels shares just as strongly in that point of view.
Right. Anytime that you want to be able to promote a cause that you care about, it's not just about what can I do strategically for this cause, what tactics should I use. You've also got to take care of yourself as a person, because this is exhausting work. And the people who get involved in activism tend to be very passionate people, hard workers. I mean, they're wonderful people, but they're also flawed people. And you've got to learn how to work with other people. And you've got to learn how to have an unpopular opinion that's going to get some resistance directed in your direction, and learn how to handle that. Because if you are an activist, not everything you do is going to be popular. Not everyone's going to be excited about everything you do. And so you've got to think about, how am I going to handle that when people are upset because I am supporting a cause I really care about that they disagree with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just in the nature of being an activist, is that you're, bringing attention to something that's going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. And, if you're going to have change, sometimes people have to be made to feel uncomfortable and see things differently and go outside their box.
Right. Change itself is very uncomfortable for many people. Even if it's a positive change, just the thought of leaving the status quo behind and not having things exactly as they always have been is a very difficult thing for many people. And so as an activist, you're going to encounter opposition. Frankly, you're going to create the opposition. And you've got to figure out how you're going to manage your life while all of this is going on around you.
Yeah. So now, for a current activist who reads this book, what would you say are a couple, one or two things that they will learn, as far as that they can apply to their activity towards a cause?
First of all, I think that people will learn that you've got to work with other people, that you're not going to accomplish the things that the suffragists accomplished together all by yourself. You need a community. And that community needs to be diverse. You need lots of perspectives. You need lots of different points of view. You need people who are approaching the problem in different ways. So I think that's one thing that you'll learn. Another is that you'll learn that there are many different ways of approaching a problem, and there's not necessarily rights and wrongs all the time. When you read my book, you'll see that lots of women and men were facing similar kinds of issues, and they handled them in different ways. And lots of those different ways worked. Lots of them were effective. We don't need everybody following one plan and one strategy to accomplish things. It's okay for people to work in their own ways and contribute in their own ways. What's important is that we're working towards common goals that we're going to reach in the end.
Yeah, that's important. You know, and just recognizing that there are multiple ways and multiple actions toward the end goal. I think just recognizing that, that itself would eliminate a lot of friction, you know, to try and come up with, quote, the one solution or, you know, the one or two things that'll make it all right, because it can't be boiled down to that small of an approach.
Right. I think that a lot of times as activists, we do get tied up in trying to get to convert other activists to our strategy and our approach. And we spend our time, I mean, maybe what we really care about is ending patriarchy, but what we're doing is we're just fighting each other. And that's never productive. So it's good to acknowledge that people are going to do things in their own way. You can't control the different approaches that people take. All you can do is be true to yourself and work in a way that feels right for you. There are different skills you can develop so you can be a better and a stronger activist. And that's what I hope is one of the things people will gain from this book, that you'll learn some skills. You'll get some ideas from people who have done it before so that you can be a better, stronger activist yourself. But that doesn't mean you're ever going to see it. There's not one right strategy. There's many different approaches that might work.
Yeah. So, you know, that would be for the activists. But for now, for this, the average non-activist person to read the book, it seems to me that these women, in addition to having their goal, their activism, but it seems that these women have just interesting lives, you know, that, and so from that standpoint, I would think that it would be just an entertaining, knowledgeable read as well.
Absolutely. One of my goals with this book is I wanted to hear these people speak as if they were alive today. So there's lots of dialogue in my book. It's written in the same way a novel might be written, where you hear people talking to each other. They're having conversations. They're having arguments. They're doing exciting things together. They're in conflicts with each other. And so it reads very much like a novel. So it's something where as you're reading it, you feel like you're there. And you feel like you really know these people. And I feel like even if you're not an activist, you need to know the people that brought us to where we are today. You need to know how we got here, how you got the rights that you have today in our country. And so this is a wonderful way, an easy, fun way to find out about some of the people that brought us to where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a time when rights seem to be slipping away, if we're not aware that we have to, you know, fight for them, that it's, you know, it's important to know that historical perspective, you know, and what led people to start a movement or create a movement or continue a movement. You know, I think we can learn a lot just by looking around us and then again, referring back to that time period.
Yeah, I think at times we think that because today our technology is so much better, the world is completely different, and there's not so much we can learn from the past. But that's not really true, because even though, yes, we do have better technology today, humankind isn't that different. You're still going to have to work with people who are sometimes difficult, who are sometimes obstinate, who maybe don't get along with you all the time, that you clash with. You're still going to have to figure out how to get along with different people, how to change people's minds if they're doing something that is causing a problem, how to raise awareness of the problems that you're facing that are affecting your family, your home, your friends. So these skills, and they haven't changed that much. The kind of people skills you need to be able to make your society a better place are still the same ones that existed 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's something. Well, now, the last topic I kind of want to touch on is the idea of there being a glass ceiling, you know, when it comes to women's advancement in the world, in holding, you know, positions of influence or power. So Can you talk about maybe, was that something that was occurring also 200 years ago? Or is that something that's kind of, you know, more relevant in today's environment?
Oh, that was happening much more so 200 years ago. We're fortunate because the women who have come before us have actually fought a lot of these battles, and things are better now than they were then. But, I mean, obviously it still exists. Back then, women weren't allowed to attend most colleges and universities. They were just completely barred from entrance. They weren't hired into many professions. Many positions were considered to be male-only jobs that women weren't allowed to have. And the laws made it very difficult for a woman to control assets. There were laws that said that as soon as a woman married, all of her property belonged to her husband, and she couldn't even withdraw her own paycheck from the bank. So this was a very difficult time, and fortunately, we've come a long way since then, thanks to the work of these people who came before us. That said, there still is a long way to go. We still have a wage gap in our country. There still aren't as many women in certain professions, such as CEOs of companies or within many STEM professions. We now have more women serving in Congress than ever before, and yet it's only a quarter of them. Women make up more than half the population, so we're certainly not equal representation there yet. So there still is a lot of inequity, but I am happy to say that we have come a long way from the time period of this book.
Yeah. You mentioned several different areas where inequity still exists. Do you think that the approaches that are being taken, you know, in those multiple different areas, again, with having that one goal of equality, that is, you know, very similar to the approach of yesteryear of attacking the problem from many different angles?
Absolutely. There are many different people trying different things. Now, not everything will work. I want to just put that in there. Like, for example, for the last several decades, we've been talking a lot about how women need to ask for wages in the same way that men do. There was evidence to suggest that women were not approaching their employers and asking for raises and promotions at the same rate that men were. And so many people drew from that that basically it's women's fault that she isn't getting promoted and isn't getting a raise because she's not asking for one. And a lot of feminist organizations put a lot of time into training women to ask for a raise or ask for a promotion. Well, very recent data shows that that worked. Many women are now asking for raises, asking for promotions. They're doing it at the same rate that men are doing it. But they're still not getting those raises or getting those promotions as often. So sometimes we get kind of excited about a certain approach. And then after a lot of work into it, after experimenting with it for a while, we realize, oh, wait, maybe that wasn't the root of the problem. In the case of women not getting those raises and promotions, it turns out it's probably not because they weren't asking. They weren't asking because women are treated differently when they ask. When a woman asks for a raise or promotion, she's more likely to be turned down. She's more likely to be seen as being demanding or unsatisfied or complaining, whereas men are more likely to be seen as being assertive and taking care of their families and providing for their families. So if women are doing the exact same thing men are doing, but they're still being seen differently, then we haven't really resolved the issue. So we will always try things, and that's fine. It's fine for us to try things and find out, oh, wait, maybe that wasn't the root of the problem, because that just gives us more knowledge that makes us more prepared to address what the real problems are. Another thing that people are doing a lot with regards to workplaces is we're in the midst of the Me Too movement, where people are saying we're not going to put up with sexual harassment in the workplace like we have for decades anymore. This isn't okay anymore. We're not going to put up with it. Men who harass women and interfere with their careers for their own personal benefit are going to be punished. And this is a very controversial approach that many aspects of it, I myself, some aspects of it I'm thrilled about, some I'm a little bit uncomfortable with. So there are going to be different things going on, but that's the way activism works. People try things. They try different approaches until they find something that really addresses the problem. And the good thing about both of these examples is that they are raising awareness of a problem. There's very few people in America today who don't know that there's a wage gap, who don't know that sexual harassment is bad. these are things that we have successfully raised awareness of, and that's the first step in making change happen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that awareness, I mean, that's where it starts, you know, and I mean, people have to recognize the inappropriate behavior, decisions, all those kinds of things. So now, are you still currently activating activists in any areas?
Yes. I'm very involved in my Mormon feminist community. That's my faith community. I also am involved more broadly in improving, making other religious faith communities more equitable nationwide. I think that this is an issue that should be important to everyone, even if you come from a more secular background, because the way we treat people on Sunday affects the way we treat them for the rest of the week. If we learn to tolerate sexism every Sunday, that's going to affect the way we look at women the next day at work. It's going to affect the way we work with women in our workplaces. It's going to affect who we vote for and whether or not we're willing to vote for women. So I think that's a very important issue. And I'm also involved in many other issues, such as education and healthcare, which all of these issues that help us to have a better life often intersect with women's issues. For example, a single woman with children is one of the demographics most likely to be in poverty in America. And it's because we don't have that safety net in place. We don't have access to healthcare. We don't have education. And often women are the ones who end up taking care of children alone, not men. And so these are issues that all intersect with each other, and I think it's important that we're working towards making our world a better place with regards to all of these different issues.
Yeah, I agree very much. So now, is this a standalone book, or are you going to have more along the same line?
I have promised that I'm going to follow up this book with a book that covers a little bit further into the future. This book ends in the 1860s, shortly after the Civil War. I am already planning and working on another book called Activists Who Built a Movement that will cover the 1870s to the 1880s. That's an exciting time period because that's when they started to have some success, not on the East Coast, but in the West. Out in the Western territories, women started voting during this time period. They started to win some battles, and people started to see what it was like when women actually had a little bit more of that opportunity to have a say in their own government. And so it's an exciting time period, and it covers a lot more questions that people, modern activists, might have, like, is it true that all press is good press, is an example, or how do we carry on the heritage of our mothers? Because as we get into the next book, we're getting into the second generation of feminists, people, some of whom were raised by feminists, and maybe they agreed with some of those ideas they were raised with, and maybe they disagreed with some of them. So it's an opportunity to see how to handle that.
Wow, that's fun. I mean, this is multi-generational, and you know, and it's great because you're bringing people along with, you know, the development of civilization, you know, as you know, and what the tools each had in those particular time periods. So that's great, April. Well, I really want to thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. It's been great.
Great. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been April Young Bennett, and we've been talking about her new book, Ask a Suffragist. Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is aprilyoungb.com. That's April Young and the letter B as in Bennett.com. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. To follow our show, visit our homepage at byteradio.me and select the platform you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at byteradio.me. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.